evening, everyone. Welcome to this edition of Blind Vine. This is Chris Gray broadcasting from what today is rather steamy downtown San Francisco. You know, we might have hit 80 degrees here. Can you believe that? It's more like our October weather, but here we are in late August getting the hot summer that we never get in San Francisco. We have a number of items for you today, and we'll start off the show in a moment by talking about a subject we all know and love, audio description. We'll talk about the iPhone a little bit later on today, various topics that have come up on ACBL in the last 2 weeks. Maybe I'll share something about a recent car trip to Santa Fe, New Mexico and back, and of course, would love to have your calls. All that coming up in just a moment on this edition of Blind Vine. Okay. First, this evening, we have a guest who has joined me by phone already. He is a person well known to ACB conventioneers, for people who attend CSUN conferences, and basically a man all about the country, and now and then from around the world, from National Captioning Institute, and wearing many other hats as well. Joel Snyder, good evening.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We had the chance to get together in an even hotter venue in Virginia recently. It was quite something, I'll tell you.
The offices of the National Captioning Institute are in Vienna, Virginia, the headquarters anyway, which is a suburb of that well-known swamp, Washington, D.C.
That's right.
Which is indeed built on an actual swamp, you know.
Where the British used to get to jungle pay, was it called?
I think that's right. So swamp in more than one sense of the word, perhaps. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe
right.
We don't want to go there. Is this a political program? I don't know.
Oh, it can be. It can be. But luckily we're not dealing here with politics. We're dealing with something a lot more fun, more exciting to ACB members.
That's right.
Joel, I really appreciated the presentation you gave. You made probably the longest and most detailed presentation. Many people may not be aware NCI does a lot of captioning for the deaf as well as audio description for the blind.
And they
really did a great job, I thought, showcasing the audio description during this meeting.
Oh, thank you.
Tell the people who are listening about the demonstration that you gave of the different kinds of audio-described or non-described video clips.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, description is a relatively new form of media access compared to captioning. Captioning's been around now for about 25 years, and I'm speaking, of course, with respect to access to media, broadcast media, and it's been mandated, required by law on the federal level, for about 15 years, a little longer than that, perhaps.
Yep, that's right.
So, in other words, folks who are deaf, who are hard of hearing, it's well recognized that they have a right to have access to the words that are spoken aloud on television. Description, I think, serves the same kind of vital function in that it makes those critical visual images of news programs, of programs that are vital to our culture, accessible to folks who can't see them. Sighted folks find it helpful, too. If you're in the kitchen washing dishes when your favorite program is on in the living room, you don't miss a beat because you hear what you can't see.
That's a good point.
When you're not in the room. Just to give you a little bit of the history as a lead-in to the specific answer to your question, in 2002, the FCC did acknowledge what we've been doing with description. Really, since 1985, I was involved with the development of the very first few programs that were described on WGBH for public broadcasting. But it wasn't until 2002 that the FCC issued a rule saying, okay, we should begin having some programs described for television. It didn't have the force of law, but as in a legislation from Congress, and that rule was indeed struck down after about 6 months in the courts.
That was really a shock to many people.
It was.
To those who've been involved in the drafting of the trial legislation,
right.
And many in ACB felt
that's
that
right.
It would be upheld. But
you're absolutely right.
Unfortunately, it wasn't, and boy, did we see a lot of folks backing away from audio description.
That's right.
When
that's
the ruling
right.
came down.
You're absolutely right. If it wasn't required, why should we do it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same thing, you know, would happen in captioning. I don't know that you'd have the same amount of captioning out there had it not been mandated by law these many years ago now. So, thanks to the Department of Education, they acknowledge that description can be a vital force in educating kids and older kids and adults too, really. But the Department of Education funding is specifically targeted K through 12, and a lot of those programs, I think, certainly can enhance material that is useful and appeals to people of all ages, really. And that funding exists to provide description to a wide range of programs, as I say. So thanks to that funding, we're able to search some companies that have been able to, been fortunate enough to receive that funding, and NCI, Describe Media, has been quite blessed to receive a good share of that funding. We've been able to continue with building our Describe Media programs. There are some networks that do pay for description out of their own pocket, but it's very limited in that sense.
Sure.
In the same way, DVDs. That's a real uphill battle too. at least in this country, adding
right.
that description track to DVDs when it's a really of minimal cost, but I think it clearly would it's a no brainer in my humble opinion. It
yeah.
would make money
yeah.
for the producers, but it's hard to convince the DVD producers of that. The ironic thing is it all developed here in the U.S., but in England, there are probably 3 to 4 times the number of DVDs with description.
Oh, they have hundreds of DVDs there.
They really do.
It's quite amazing.
And it's all the more shocking, though, when you realize how small the population in the U.K. is compared
yes.
to the U.S. But,
yeah. But tell us, Joel, about the video that you demonstrated
yeah.
showing
well,
the different tracks.
You know, I'll tell you the best way, perhaps, to tell you about it is
yeah.
to show you by, and I've got a couple of examples lined up here for you.
No kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
Well, I appreciate that.
I thought I would play a couple that, one I've got here that is, a real short one, and this one I'd like to do, because it's short, I'd like to play the original soundtrack from this movie, and I'll play with your listeners here for a second, and with you, Chris, because I don't think you've heard this one.
I should have known to expect something.
There you go. The original soundtrack, without description, this is an excerpt from the actual soundtrack of a very famous movie.
Mm-hmm.
I will give you that much. Pretty well-known film, and no added description. Just listen to the original soundtrack, and just from that, can you tell what's going on? Now, there are going to be some musical hints in there, so I think you'll have some idea, but can you really tell what's going on without the description? Does the description add anything when you hear it a second time through with the description? You guys tell me. You tell me, Chris.
Okay.
I don't know if you're... So let's listen to it once without description, and does it do much for you or what?
Okay.
Here we go.
Oh, my gosh.
What was going on there, Chris?
Well, I heard a lot of pathos in the music. So we start out with some pathos.
Pathos, okay.
And my gosh, were those wild animals in the background or
well,
some kind
good.
Of monster from science
okay.
fiction movie?
Yeah.
I guess I was, well, maybe tigers. They had to be tigers. That's what
tigers.
It was.
Tigers, okay. I don't know. Gee, now if this was a call-in show, we could have your listeners, take some guesses too.
Yeah, well, it'll be call-in, but later because
later on. Okay,
you've got the only line.
Now I'm curious though because as I said, there's some musical clues there too. So it depends on how familiar you are with this movie, and it's part of a package. It's part of a series of films. So. And if you're not a fan of this series, then you wouldn't know, perhaps. But so you hear this without description, and if you don't have access to the visual image, I suffice it to say, what do you get? You get pathos, you get tiger. That's not really enough to hold one's interest, perhaps. I don't
quite know. Quite so.
Let's add some description.
Okay.
And see if that does a little bit more.
All right.
You. Okay.
Let's give it a try.
Stretches his hand toward the weapon's handle. It wobbles slightly. He closes his eyes, reaches out again. It moves a bit more. The beast rises and lumbers toward him. The weapon leaps into his hand, and a long, smooth shaft of light glows from its tip. He frees his feet and drops down, then splashes out at the beast, severing its arm. He runs out of the cave into the storm, scrambling up a ridge and tumbling down the far side, a tiny figure struggling through the snow.
Hey.
Did that make a little more sense?
It did. It did. I guess I wouldn't say it was a tiger anymore, just a beast.
Yes, that's right. It's golly, I'm trying to think of the name of the beast. The ice beast, perhaps. That was an excerpt from the Star Wars movie, The Empire Strikes Back.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So if you're familiar with the Star Wars series of, six films, I think.
Well, there was quite a few, that's for sure.
That was described actually before I came and took over became the director of Describe Media at NCI. I described that for Fox Broadcasting through my own company, Audio Description Associates, which is still quite active, describing museums and performing arts. And training describers around the world.
I was going to say, that voice doing the describing sounded oddly familiar.
So I wrote and voiced the description for that when it was broadcast on
right,
Fox.
Right,
some 7 or 8 years ago, I think. So that's the kind of thing that I, as you recall, demonstrated during the... and then we, of course, the gathering that you were at in Washington, where at our headquarters in Virginia, was focused on education.
Right, right.
And how our funding from the Department of Education is used. So we could play a little bit from... your listeners may know that we do the description for Sesame Street.
Exactly, exactly.
And I can play a little bit of that for you, and I have a variety of other segments as well. But as just to give folks a taste of what description is about.
Well, I think this was a great example.
Sure.
And you know, we hear about it now and then. We talk about, well, it must be very effective for sighted people. I think even for blind people who hear a segment like that described and then hear it again undescribed.
Oh, yeah.
Or, sorry, vice versa, really,
is
the most effective. And it really does have an impact. I got to ask you, Joel.
Sure.
Is that video, the Star Wars video or any of the others, are they currently available for a blind person to purchase?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't think that one is in particular, and actually I don't believe any of them are, and it's part of this sad state of affairs, really, with respect to having the movie producers, the DVD producers, having them be willing to either take on the description themselves and
mm-hmm.
add the description to the track when they release the DVDs, or even licensing the films to a company that would then do the description and then market the DVDs separately, one or the other. And it's to be honest, I think that it's something that perhaps they would respond to users of description if those voices were heard more forcefully.
Yes.
And so that folks know that there's a market out there for it, and not just as I say, not just folks who are blind or have low vision, but
mm-hmm.
The idea that there are other ways to market the description on CDs, for instance, for folks who, making a long drive in the car, you could take that soundtrack with description. You're driving a car, nobody's going to be watching a movie, but you could listen to on your CD or on an MP3 player or what have you. So in that way, the market is greatly expanded, and that only then benefits the folks who are blind, because then they get the product finally.
That's right. You know, and I was so impressed. There was a lady there who is the mother of a number, I guess, of deaf kids.
That's right.
Who are adults. And she was telling us something I had no idea of, and that was the deteriorating state of captioning for the deaf.
That's right.
And how she'd gotten a group together to talk about, you know, what they might want her to bring to the advisory meeting. And they were all complaining about this captioning and that captioning and errors and problems and lack of standards now between one station and another. And she made the point, and I was so happy to hear her say it, you've got to get out there and advocate. The deaf community is way ahead of us in captioning. On the other hand, again, they've gotten complacent. They've fallen behind from where they were 3 to 5 years ago. And if there's one thing that I believe more than anything else, it is that the blind people themselves, we ourselves, have got to go to Congress. We've got to go to the manufacturers of DVDs. The thing is, Joel, if we can go with you and other people who are professionals in the field and who know it from the trenches, we know it from our living rooms and theaters.
You know
it from the trenches. And so you put those two perspectives together, it's got to be a winner.
I think you're right. Absolutely. I think especially from the user's perspective, always I think you need to begin from the user's perspective.
Yes.
And once those voices are heard strongly, forcefully, I think it's a matter of something that's really a right to have access to culture.
Yes.
And
yes.
That's what description for film and television is about.
Now, I'm going to have to move away from you about 5:30.
Sure.
Or 8:30 your time, but I don't want you to get away without telling us more about your company and some of the exciting work you've done recently, especially, as I understand it, in museums.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I make it a point. I was in that first group of audio describers back in 1980, 81, working with Cody and Margaret Fanstiel,
right.
Here out of the Washington Ear, and Chet Avery was working out of the Department of Education, thinking up some of these ideas, golly, back in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was part of the group that you were in, of course.
It was great to see Chet. I haven't seen or spoken with him for years and years.
That's right. Well,
he got to meet his granddaughter.
There you go. That's right. And coming from those beginnings, I believe strongly that the principles, the fundamentals of audio description apply across the board to all venues, all genres, really, film, television, theater, dance, performing arts, static visual arts, media, museums, exhibits. But even other kinds of venues as well. We spoke a little bit about working with literacy and children's books. I'll be away part of September and October doing description on cruises with people just accompanying blind tours, groups of blind individuals.
No kidding.
Tours. Sure. There's description of parades and rodeos and et cetera, that kind of thing. And, yeah, with my company, much of the work that my Audio Description Associates does is making museum exhibits accessible. I've done work for the Getty in Los Angeles, for the Albright Knox in Buffalo, many of the Smithsonian museums, in Florida, the whole group of museums there in St. Petersburg, Florida. Working right now with a number of the Park Service and the Forest Service exhibit centers, making their exhibits accessible. And what's a nice part of that, too, is when I go to these places, I really make it my business to work with the docents and guides greet people, who take people around individually. I think they need to learn about description and about just develop a sense of access awareness that they understand the needs of folks who are blind, folks who have low vision, so that I think it makes them better docents just in general.
Yes.
When they can, they learn to observe, they learn to pick out from the things they're discussing with more, just be able to discern what they're talking about, discriminate a little bit better, and discuss it with a better, finer use of language.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what description is about. So I always train docents when I'm on site to develop an audio described tour, and we get it recorded using digital means now. I remember some of the very first tours I developed were just audio cassettes, we've gone way beyond that now. But we do a lot of, I've been fortunate to be able to do a lot of those kinds of projects over the last, 15, 20 years now.
Well, that is great. And I'm sure there are so many more out there to do. You know, I was shocked a little bit. We were in Santa Fe, and we went to the oldest mission in North America, Mission to San Miguel. And they've got this great large booklet there, you know, four heavily covered print sheets, you can give yourself a self-guided tour. Now, that would be fine, and our friend was willing to read as much or as little of that as we wanted to, but they had no audio-guided tour of any kind.
Right.
So if you ever want to go to Santa Fe, and August might not be your first choice because it was darn near as hot there as it was when we met in Virginia.
Right.
But, you know, it was amazing to me and clear that they'd never even thought about a described tour or an audio tour.
No, we've got a long way to go there. In the same way, I think, I guess that's why I decided to really press forward with media. I think once description is better known in media, then it will come along more quickly in theater and in museums. But museums are an area that I think they just haven't learned how to make themselves more welcoming of folks who were blind.
And
they need to be. There's just no reason why anybody with a quote-unquote physical disability must also be culturally disadvantaged. It's the responsibility of that museum to be totally accessible. So and they're coming around. Some
they
are better than others, but
it's
a long
time.
Road.
It takes time and advocacy. You know, for a long time it was unthinkable that you would go into a museum and, God forbid, touch anything.
Yes, yes.
But you know, the Rodin Museum in Paris opened the way.
Yeah.
And the world has changed.
You're
because
right.
of that. And I think we can go on doing that. I just hope people go to the Rodin Museum and other places and experience what there is to experience. We're getting almost to 5:30,
right.
But tell me the last couple of museums you did.
Oh, golly. Well, I've been doing so many of these visitor centers for the government, and which is a great thing because the government has a regulation, the Title 508, that requires many of their facilities and films to be made accessible. I'm working right now on an exhibit center in just outside Eugene, Oregon, the Mackenzie Bridge Visitor Center of the Forest Service.
Oh, that's a beautiful area.
It is a beautiful area out there, not too far away from where you are in San Francisco, just kind of north, obviously. But so I've done a number of those. Did a magnificent transportation exhibit at the Air and Space Museum. I'm sorry, the National American History Museum in at the Smithsonian. That was a large undertaking here in Washington, and a tour of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York.
Oh my
which
gosh!
Is actually on the web, and I should have the web address with me, and I don't. But it is a great thing because it's that they did by putting it on the web, really, because on the web. It makes it accessible to so many more people.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That is great.
So, yeah.
Is it the description itself that's on the web?
Exactly so.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah.
Send that to me, and if you put it in the email in the next several days, I'll mention it next week here on the show.
There you go. That'd be great.
That's great. Joel, it's 5:30, and I've got to leave some time for a couple phone calls that I tried to set up over last 7 days. I'm so appreciative of you being here, and I hope that everybody else enjoyed it. I'm sure they did.
Thank you so much, Chris. I am proud to be a part of the program.
Well, we'll have you again.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, Chris. Talk to you later.
Thanks a lot. Bye. That was Joel Snyder from the National Captioning Institute and his own organization, the Audio Description Association. I probably just butchered that name because I didn't write it down ahead of time, which I always ought to do. never rely on your memory when you're on the air, right? Well, okay, folks, that was the first half hour of The Blind Vine, and let me ask you to consider calling during this next half hour. Remember, the less you call, the more you call, the less you hear of me. The phone number is 888-881-1998. It's a toll-free number. That's 888-881-1998, and you're listening to Blind Vine coming to you from the James Flood Building in the heart of downtown San Francisco. During this second half hour, we'll spend some time talking about the American Council of the Blind, talking about issues that have come up on ACBL, and let me begin by just reiterating a few words that I wrote the other day regarding the passing of a great person in the field of disabilities. Before I do that, though, I'll take this call. Good afternoon. You're on Blind Line in San Francisco. This is Chris Gray. Who am I talking to?
Chris Gray. This is Marvelina.
Oh, Marvelina. Yes, okay.
How are you?
I'm fine.
I'd like to ask, and I would have asked him, Joel remained on the line, what is some of the similarities and differences between the National Captioning Institute and WGBH in terms of what they do and the sort of things they describe?
NCI and WGBH. Well, I could send Joel an email and he'll write probably more than I can think of. The main ones that came out in the advisory committee meeting are the great extent that NCI has focused on children's programming.
Mm-hmm.
This is partly because of a large grant they got from the Department of Education.
Yeah.
But it's also because, you know, everybody has to find their space. And while NCI has done TV programming and they have done some work in the area of movies, primarily, they have focused on things like Sesame Street and other educational videos and educational TV, some on PBS, some on other channels that are used primarily by people involved in homeschooling.
Uh-huh.
But it's all through the Department of Education.
Okay.
So I'd say that's the lion's share of their work. And it was amazing to be in their studios. They have such incredible connectivity into all the networks and Fox, CNN for the closed captioning work that they do.
That's really fantastic.
It really is. You know, if we could get that over to audio description, the infrastructure's there already.
Mm-hmm.
All we have to do is make our voice heard and get some of the video work going at the same time.
Well, thank you very much, Chris Gray, and good luck on your show.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call.
Uh-huh.
So, a little description of the differences between WGBH and NCI. And probably we ought to do some work and find out how many more professional organizations are out there doing audio description today. Over the weekend, we learned of the passing of Frank Bowe, one of the most important, certainly one of the most well-known individuals from our friends over in the deaf community. I had the opportunity to meet Frank Bowe in 1976 when we were working with through Reese Robron and ACB and many other organizations trying to get the first set of rulemaking released for Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1974. That act was a great act. We're using it today. It's the basis of ACB's currency litigation. We hadn't even gotten rules passed for it in 1976. And going to those conferences, I got to meet a lot of people throughout the disabled community, a lot of folks in the blind community that I had never met, never heard of. But Frank Bowe was a real spokesman for the deaf community and a real spokesman as well for championing the rights of all disabled people and seeing to it that no disability group got shunted aside, got let out, left out, and got put into a difficult or impossible situation during the negotiations about those regulations. Now, there were others who were taking care of disabled groups as well, but I thought that Frank really went out of his way to make sure that the people heard each other, and throughout many years of working with him off and on, we'd run across each other. I remember one time in the mid-1980s, we were doing a video for one of the TV stations in the Washington, D.C. area, and Frank was there, and again, very much playing the role of discussing the deaf and their problems, and of course, he and I were always agreeing with one another about categorical services, how important categorical services were, and we just ran across each other over the years in that kind of capacity. Frank was very active throughout the disabled community, and really a great, great loss. A number of people have written about that and echoed it, and so if anybody wishes to speak about Frank today, that would be fine. Share any experiences you have or ask questions. Once again, the number is area code 888, so it's toll free, 888-881-1998. Continuing on ACBL is the discussion about Apple, the iPhone, which has led to a discussion about iPods and iMacs and many, many other things. I thought we might possibly have a call tonight regarding that. This could be it, but we'll find out. Good evening, and welcome to the Blind Vine. I'm Chris Gray, and who am I speaking to?
Hi, Chris. It's Sue Amateur.
Oh, hey, Sue.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay, thanks. How are you?
Good. Did you have a nice vacation?
Vacation was good. Although, I must tell you, driving through the Mojave Desert in August is something I might think twice about next time.
Well, yeah, I would think so, but why would you have to think twice? I wouldn't go once.
Well, the desert's a pretty amazing place, but, you know, we got to a small town. It's near the town of Mojave in eastern California, quite a ways south and even further east from San Francisco.
And people really live there?
They do. They really do. I don't know how.
Gross.
At 9 o'clock at night, it was 98 degrees, and the sun had set. That's hot.
They probably don't have to buy a lot of coats then.
I don't think so.
They may pay
double price for shorts, but...
Can you imagine if the air conditioning went out?
Oh, my gosh. It would be tough.
Or if your car broke down. That actually would be the scary part. I mean...
Yeah.
Hopefully the roads are traveled enough that wouldn't matter, but...
Well, our experience was that most of the fellow travelers on those roads were great big trucks carrying things, you know, from one place to another.
It's probably not a big vacation, sorry.
No, probably not. But I got to say, Santa Fe was a wonderful place for a vacation. And despite the fact that it's 7,000 feet in the air and a little high up.
How high is Denver? I can't remember.
Denver is, they call it the Mile High City.
So I guess it's about
5,000 feet.
Okay.
So Albuquerque is about 6,000, and Santa Fe is about 7,000.
So did you go in a hot air balloon?
No.
Good. I don't think I'm going to go in one after what happened in B.C.
I don't, even before B.C., I don't think you would ever catch me in a hot air balloon.
Somehow it sounds a little creepy. I mean, anyway.
I don't know why. What it is, a blind person like me being afraid of heights, but I have no interest in being in a balloon whatsoever.
Well, it's kind of like I remember as a kid, I'd go up in the high dive, and I'd think, well, there's nothing that would preclude me from diving off this, right? Because you can't... Well, I never dove, and every time I jumped, I thought, I'm not doing this again, you know, and that was like 10 feet, so... Well,
I know what you mean. I know what you
mean. I sure never had the privilege of knowing Frank Bowe. Certainly, I knew a lot about him, but I never met him. But I'm assuming that he is kind of like another Justin Dart.
I think so. He probably didn't have the reach of Justin Dart, but he never had the opportunity to work for the president either.
He also didn't have the money that Justin had.
Well, that's true.
Which, you know, in fairness to Justin, that gave him tremendous opportunity to do. I mean, he was never stingy, as any if anybody knew Justin.
That's right. That's right.
Justin would come into a room of people and buy the whole room a meal. He didn't even quake at doing it. That's not the right word, but you know.
I know what you mean. No, it's true. He was very generous with what he had. And, well, remember that time he came into the ACB convention and he became the first life member of ACB.
You know, that's right.
That was not a minor effort, you know. You don't have $1,000 laying around all the time.
Well, no.
And this was many years ago, too.
I can't remember what year that it was, but I'm going to say maybe 94 or 95. When the ADA was coming under attack, and Justin actually went to all 50 states and traveled. And that was no easy thing for Justin because,
true.
I mean, he wasn't just a wheelchair user. He was pretty severely disabled.
Yes.
He had a lot of dietary restrictions and, you know, Yoshiko always went with him. Well, anyway, he went to California and did a town. He did two town meetings, and because he did town meetings in every state.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to Seattle and did a town meeting, and I was on the governor's committee then, so we organized it, and we had it at Seattle Community College.
Mm-hmm.
And we got about 200 people there, which I was really pleased that people came out. And the next day, Yoshiko, who, if you never met her, was the most elegant of people.
Mm, no, I did not ever meet her.
Oh, I mean, she was just elegant. That's all I could say about her. And she called me at work and said, "We just want to thank you for doing the meeting." And I thought, "Thank me?" You know, just. And I'll tell you another little thing. And so about 2 weeks later, I get this package at work. And it's a silver cup, just plain, no base or anything. Just,
wow.
And a small silver cup that said, "Thank you for all that you've done." And I just cried. I mean, and I didn't expect it. I didn't. Anyway, but I had the privilege of being able to go back to Justin's memorial service, which,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, was quite a thing. And I really wanted to go, and my affiliate sent me. And we went to the service, and, you know, Charlie Crawford was part of the people who talked, and
mm-hmm.
I went
mm-hmm.
Charlie Hodge. And anyway, afterwards they had a big celebration at the Union Station, you know, the big downtown.
That big new station they've got built.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, and it was, of course, packed with people, as you
I'll
can
bet.
Imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And the darts paid for everything. I mean, they paid for the food and the drink, and the headbands.
My gosh.
And, I
wow.
mean, it was packed. And
uh-huh.
I was getting ready to leave, and I ran into, Yoshiko was standing up front. And I went up and I said, you know, "Thank you for having us." And she said, "Oh, my goodness, you traveled all the way from Washington State.
Mm.
Justin and I want to thank you." And I thought, again, but that's how she was.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's really a sad thing. There is such a small handful of people throughout the disabled community who have the ability, financial or otherwise, to exert that kind of leadership.
And there aren't many.
Nope.
I mean, there really aren't. I mean, Justin was one, if you say Frank Bow, maybe.
Yes, I mean, I think...
Durwood certainly was.
Yep, yep.
And, you know, and so was Kenneth Jernigan.
Yes, I think you're right.
I mean, if you have to write down the people who spent their lives, you don't have to agree with everything that they did, but...
Oh, no, no.
But the idea
is, who would another disabled person think about from our community, or who would we think about from their community? And, you know, I think you got the right names in mind there.
And I think the thing about, from what you said about Frank and with Justin, they transcended all disabilities.
Yes.
I mean, Justin would walk up to a person in a wheelchair or a deaf person or a blind person. He
right.
didn't care.
Well, and it was lucky for us. Frank did not have great speech, but he had intelligible speech.
Oops, sorry.
For at least, you know, a simple conversation. And for a blind person, that made him, from the deaf community, much more approachable.
Yeah, because sometimes it's really hard when you're trying to do it with an interpreter.
Oh,
and that
my
doesn't
gosh.
Mean,
yeah.
That doesn't mean they don't want to talk with us, but
nope.
sometimes...
It's just a physical impossibility.
It'd be interesting to come up with some, you know, other names around the country that... I think Lex Frieden he's an excellent speaker, by the way, if you've never heard him.
No, I haven't. I haven't.
But it'd be interesting to come up with some names, because there really are some people, and we need to be growing up some more, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But certainly Justin and Frank and Eunice.
Yes.
And I never knew Eunice.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to her once on the phone, and that's when I only really talked contact with her. But you remember Paul Wysocki in our state. He was quite good friends with Eunice.
Oh,
he
right,
always...
right. Yeah, Eunice used to have good parties, too. My gosh.
I bet she did.
Now, there's something to aspire
and
to.
I bet they weren't mild things she served, either.
Not necessarily. I mean, it was your choice if you wanted to have water, but hey. And a lot of good work was done at those meetings. Of course, in 1996, when we were fighting through those 504 regs, Eunice was living in New York and working out of the mayor's office.
I remember that.
And, boy, when she came down to Washington, people noticed.
Oh, I bet they did, because Paul always called her Unis.
That's so funny.
But there were a lot of names that we, you know, could go back and recreate.
Yes.
That, again, transcended more than just one disability.
Yeah.
And who did it gladly, and that was the more important thing, that we learned to know a lot about each other.
Yes.
And each other's needs. That's one thing I was always grateful for being on our governor's committee. I learned a lot about deaf people, which I had no clue about, a lot about people with wheelchairs.
Sure.
And they did the same, because most of the time you only know your own disability. And some people don't want to go beyond that, and it's really unfortunate when they don't.
We do tend to get isolated from one another, or be isolated because we don't have contact.
Right.
And some
people, or we think, oh, you know, those wheelchair guys don't have it as tough as we do. Or blah, blah. We all have it tough and different. Sorry, that's Buddy with squeaky. I tried to get away with his bark.
He comes Buddy. Over the microphone real well.
Buddy. <Jeez. laughs> Sorry about that. Oh, this is a family show, obviously.
Absolutely. Why not?
Anyway, I just wanted to call. I flipped on a little bit. I'll have to listen later to hear the fellow from the...
Oh, Joel Snyder. Yeah, he did a demo.
And you'll come back on at 9 our time, is it?
Yes. It's either 8 or 9. I'm not totally sure.
Yeah, so... Anyway, I'll buzz off so other folks can call in.
All right. Well, thank you, Sue.
And hopefully I'll talk with you soon.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Sue Amateur from Seattle, well, not from Seattle, Washington any longer. I shouldn't say that. From the state of Washington. That's what I should say. You know, it seems like there are two times where the disabled community really got together, came together in a big way, and got together learning, helping one another. One was that 1976 through 78 period of the rulemaking for Section 504. The other was during the time when we all decided that we simply had to get an ADA, and we had to really work together, create legislation that we felt could be passed, that we felt could be lived with, and then go and make it happen. And once again, during that time, the whole disabled community came together, and in fact, we did make the ADA happen. Will we be able in this Congress or some other Congress down the road to create a new ADA, a better ADA, not one that has been gutted by the court? I don't know. But we ought to try. I've been asked by in emails and elsewhere to run the program that I ran during my first show here about Coyle and Sharp on the Loose, and I will now run my intro and the program once again. My parents gave me a 6-transistor Admiral radio. I don't know if any of you remember the Admiral brand name or 6-transistor radios, but for me, that's a radio I'll never forget. It was fairly small. It was only AM, but it had a great speaker. It had a very cool leather case with a great leather smell, and it had the ability to pick up radio broadcasts from literally all over the Western United States. At first, I indulged myself by finding stations in Tacoma or Everett, even Portland, Oregon. But before long, I made this incredible discovery that I could, on many, many evenings, especially in the summer, get a radio station out of a town far away but well known to me and discussed very often, San Francisco, California. Yes, I was able to get radio station KGO clearly and delightedly on my part, and I would spend many an evening listening to the variety of programming that KGO had to offer. Fairly soon, I found a program that captured my imagination on a number of levels. It was called On the Loose, and it was put on by two very funny San Franciscans, James Coyle and Mal Sharp. They became great personalities to me. They were great personalities to San Franciscans and heard all up and down the West Coast. Their particular claim to fame was to catch people on the street, engage them in a conversation, and see what they might be able to talk a person into doing. They would try to talk people into taking certain kinds of animals into their homes. They would pretend to be celebrities and get someone to believe they were talking to a big celebrity, any number of things. It was really a radio version and an earlier version of a television show, you might recall, named Candid Camera. Coyle and Sharp shaped my view of San Francisco and made me decide at a very early age this was a city in which I intend to live. And now I do. In these programs of The Blind Vine, I'm planning to bring you a lot of texture, sound, maybe even personalities of today from San Francisco. But today, I'd like to play for you at least one of the Coyle and Sharp broadcasts that began to introduce this city to me. Now, one thing I'll point out to you, I loved this as a kid and still do like it, and you may find it enjoyable too. As you listen to the broadcast, you'll hear one cable car bell, and then a lot of other interesting street noise, older sounding cars, sirens, and so forth. These are clearly on the street presentations and very interesting and fun in that way. Ladies and gentlemen, Coyle and Sharp from an undated broadcast in the early 1960s on the streets of San Francisco, trying to convince a man to help them rob a bank.
We've just stopped a gentleman. A young man is in the Navy. Could we have your name, please?
Lewis.
Lewis, I'd like you to meet James Pete Coyle.
Glad to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you. Now, Lewis, Mr. Coyle is going to tell you very briefly about a film he's working on here in the city, and after he finishes, if you want to discuss any aspect of it,
I'd like to. I really would.
Okay, fine. Mr. Coyle, would you tell Lewis about the film?
Very good. The name of the film is Daring But Dead. The idea is very simply, it centers around a bank robbery which takes place in a city. We hope to approach it in a unique way, and we're actually going to film it in a bank. Do you understand the nature of it?
I come from Philadelphia. I'd like to know it. I really would.
Right. Everybody in the bank will be actors, but we're going to try and get the main role, in other words, the protagonist of this film, we're going to use a person without dramatic background. Would you yourself be interested in giving a crack at that role? There's no money involved, but there's a possibility for fame.
Yes, I really would. I mean, I think it'd be a good film. I really do. I honestly do.
The idea is you are to go in the bank, ask for $11,000. You can use some type of a weapon or not. And we are actually, I've chosen Mr. Sharp from the radio station, and myself are playing two of the other roles in the film. We'll be sitting out in a car outside the bank. Would you be willing to give it a try?
I would be, because I'm a gunner's mate in the Navy, and I know I could do it. I mean, I just walk in, I hold it up.
Yeah.
Because, the man that's never committed a crime before is the one that can do it.
Right,
that's
exactly true.
I could do it. I can get hold of a machine gun. I can get hold of any kind of weapon you want.
Would you be willing? We're doing some filming this afternoon. Would you be willing to try it?
Yes, I would.
Fine, we'll go up to a bank here. Would you be able to get a hold of a weapon this afternoon?
Yeah, I would.
You won't see the cameras. We'll just go in. It'll look like a regular bank robbery. No cameras, nothing.
That's right. I would. I'd go in there.
And you'd come out with the money and meet us in the car.
That's right.
All right, let's go.
Okay, fine.
What's wrong?
That's a good plan. What do you mean, what's wrong?
Well, you going to go with us?
Yeah, I'll go with you. What do you mean?
What are you going to do?
I don't hold up a bank.
Okay, let's go.
Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Come on.
What do you mean, come on?
We're going to do it now.
You've agreed to hold the bank up, right?
What's wrong?
What do you mean, what's wrong? You guys actually want to hold up a bank right now, don't
right.
you? I know you do. You guys got a gun?
No.
You were going to have the gun.
You would be the guy who'd go in the bank.
What kind of guys are you?
We're just out to make a buck, and if we can use a guy that's got no criminal
experience.
Yeah.
You guys are all right. Which bank? You're not yet.
The bank right down on the corner.
You guys are just going to walk in there.
You walk in.
Me?
You walk in. We wait outside in the car.
You guys got a good scheme here.
You know, we've discussed it with you pretty openly. You know the score.
Yeah.
We get you to go in the bank. You take the risk. We sit out in the car. We get the money. If you're caught, you know, you don't even know who we are. So we have no past association with you.
That's right. See, if I get shot by the cop, but you guys don't know nothing.
Yeah,
right.
We just drive
right.
off. You're
I'm
lying
a,
there. In the,
I'm a stoolie, right?
You're a pitcher.
Yeah.
You're lying on the steps of the bank, riddled with bullets, and we're driving across the bridge.
Yeah, I'd want one of you guys with me.
Where?
In the bank.
Can we explain something to you?
Yeah.
You won't be angry with us?
Nah.
This is all in the interest of humor.
Let me say one thing.
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
You two guys, with a scheme like that, just stopping a guy on the street with a policeman right next to me.
Yeah.
You could actually pull off a job like that.
Sure
you could. Three men.
Right.
I'm serious.
And, ladies and gentlemen, that comedy routine brings us to the end of another show of The Blind Vine. This is the third show over 4 weeks. I want to thank Marlena for trying to get us on last week, but things didn't quite work out. We did get back this week. It's been a great hour, and please join me again next Wednesday at 5 o'clock Pacific, 0 o'clock UTC, for another edition of The Blind Vine. Thank you.